This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Welcome to episode number 165 of FilmWax Radio. Early on when I started writing about films, and I never thought I was particularly talented at it, I thought I could put together a review fairly well. But I was writing for a couple of different people, and one of the early outlets I wrote for was this small film review website called Film Forward. And the editor of that site's name is Kent Turner. And you may know Kent, you may not. He's not really one to hanging out with everybody. He sort of does his own thing, but he's been at this for a long time. And he's fully committed and very thoughtful about what he does. So a few, like a month or so ago, or maybe 2 months ago, after Ken, I invited him on. So you can look back on a few episodes back and maybe listen to that. But as you may know, if you're remotely involved in the film industry or the independent film community, we just, the Toronto International Film Festival just ended. And that's a major film festival in the whole scheme of things, and Kent was there, and so I invited him on, and you're going to hear that in just a moment, my conversation with Kent. After that is the filmmaker Sean O'Callaghan, who has a new documentary called Men at Lunch, which is about the history and the mystery of this famed photograph called Lunch Atop a Skyscraper, which was Irish-Americans and possibly there's some Polish people or Italian, I don't know, but they're sitting on that beam way above the city having lunch, and it's one of the most famous photographs. And so he made this documentary. It's played through the festivals. It's currently in theaters, so you can see it. It's called Men at Lunch, and we'll have him on after that. And then finally, the filmmakers Damon Malucci and Keir Politz, who together have made a film called Detonator. And I talk with them, and we're joined by one of the leading actors of the film, my friend Ben Fine. And that film has been traveling through various and sundry film festivals. And it is going to be playing in a small film festival in Bay City, Michigan. The festival is called Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival, which takes place September 26th through the 29th. I will put the date and details on the description of this podcast on the Rooftop Films website, but basically Detonator stars Ben Fine and Lawrence Michael Levine. I should mention that Sophia Decal is in it as well, and a number of other talented actors and actresses, including the great Robert Longstreet. So there you go. So we'll have on Damon, Keir, and Ben on this last segment as I make my way to the great state of Michigan to be a juror in that festival. So, again, first up is Mr. Kent Turner, and we'll be back in a little bit.
Said you give me life, but you never told me about the fire.
It was We're in the home of Kent Turner, and he's complaining. He's talking about how tiring going to Toronto International Film Festival is. Come on in here, Kent. Can come in here and complain about how tiring it is to go to international film festivals, even though Toronto isn't too far.
No.
Kent Turner, welcome back to Film
Thank you.
Radio. We're looking at paper.
I have notes just for reference.
Me too, though.
To jog my memory.
Right. Nothing like a memory jogged.
Well, I mean, the main reason is I think I saw, 36 films.
That's...
in their entirety.
Shocking to me. How many in
about it was a little more than a week. And
what did you do? Okay, so where did you stay? Where were you staying?
I was staying in downtown Toronto, but on the east side. So I had to take a bus to the Bell Lightbox in the center of Toronto. So it was about a 15-minute commute, but. I don't know how I did it. Actually, at some days I felt hungover, even though I wasn't, just because of lack of sleep. And you were eating on the, just whatever you could—a muffin
right
here,
the
a muffin there. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait. So how did you? So you saw 36 films.
Yes.
So if we do the division,
I think so. Yeah.
So you saw about half a dozen films.
No, well, I was there actually from Friday. I left a Saturday. So it was almost 8 days of viewing. Not quite.
I've never been able to do anything like that.
Well, see, there's such a temptation because they say there was roughly 288 films at Toronto. So you feel like you have to binge.
Did you see August Osage County?
No.
Okay.
No, but there was like three other films to see that were screening at the same time.
Well, you don't have to explain it to me.
Right. No. But I'm just saying that it's tough to make a choice at an event like this where there's just too much.
Yeah.
Let me see. Well, for example.
All right.
Well,
so So how many films do you think you saw in a day?
Typically five. One day there were six. Another day four, but it averaged to be about five. So it was roughly from about 9 a.m. until about 10 at night. So maybe an hour here, 45 minutes in between, more or less. Sometimes I even made it to a party.
But you were seeing movies all the waking time.
Yes. Basically, yes.
Right?
That's what
I mean, basically, with breaks. That was your day, right?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So you
and
get
I had
up
no
at what
interviews,
time?
So it was just
right.
focused on the films.
What time did you get up?
7:30.
Right.
I know, which is early for me.
And you get to bed. Right. And you get to bed what time?
12:31.
Okay. So that's how it's done, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
But you know, in some sense, what you've done is you've saved yourself a lot of evenings off now.
Exactly.
Okay. Because, ladies and gentlemen who are listening who may not understand it, is that 36 films out of, let's say, you see approximately 300 a year?
Yeah, I would say so, 250
to 250
to
300 a year.
That's a good estimate.
So you've taken off quite a few weekends, at least,
yes.
in a sense. So that's pretty amazing. That's great, right?
Yeah.
And how many film festivals now, Kent Turner?
Yes.
Do you think? Well, you're at Cannes, and you're mm-hmm. attorney. Is this like for you? Are you choosing to go to these as a now to try to just experience the like state of the art film festival?
It's that also. Okay, this year I went to Cannes because I always wanted to go to Cannes. It was more like a birthday present to myself. And with Toronto, I felt it was the pink elephant in the room. It's not far away. I had never been to it. I do try to go to one festival a year. Sometimes, a major
really?
Festival. If I can do more, that's fantastic. I also try and see as many festivals here in New York, and you know there's a festival every weekend. And so, I mean,
it is different.
Doesn't
count. Yeah.
Right, it is different. But usually I try to go to Venice, and this year I actually did go to Venice in a way because they had web streaming of about a dozen films, and I saw eight, and it was
great. So does that mean
you
got your credentials, but you stayed home?
Yes. Okay. Well, you pay for it, but it's only like
$5. For credentials?
No. For at Venice, this was the streaming. So you pay for the streaming video, and
that means you didn't get credentials, though.
I didn't apply for it.
All right, we'll take that out anyway. It doesn't matter.
But
that's fine.
But I am reviewing.
Nobody
it,
cares
so.
About that. Yeah, no, I understand though. But you're getting into the. You have to see the films. So and then you went to Cannes, and then you're at Toronto. That's remarkable. And for me, I have like my three good friends who live there. So for me, it's really just ridiculous how easy it would be to do this. But
really
believe
should.
It or not, it's ridiculous. But there is something to this fact that it's just, for me, it's too big.
It is.
It
could easily be 2 or 3 weeks. Why they compact it all in, 12 days? And like today, I was looking at IndieWire to see what their rankings of the films were. There were films I never heard of. And I went through the catalog, I thought, very carefully. And I spent hours just trying to decide, okay, what's my plan of action? But even then, something will slip in and slip by you.
Of course.
Oh, well. But that's
you think you've got it figured out, then you don't even realize.
Exactly. But I'm glad. I mean, I did not see one film that I hated or thought it was the worst thing.
I think you said that about Cannes, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So educational guesses. You know, a good hunch sometimes will lead you.
How long have you been doing the film review business?
Well, film review for 10 years. But I did work way back in the day for the San Francisco International Film Festival.
Okay.
So I was kind of familiar, you know.
Right. But the point being is that it's not as arbitrary. You get certain... You know, we I guess the whole philosophy of outlier kind of after a certain number of 1,000 hours, you get a sense
of what you want to see and what directors
you know what to look for.
More
you know the
less.
Signals. You can read
try
the
to look.
No, I'm not saying it's 100%.
Right.
So okay, let's get into it. What were some of the exciting films? I'll bring up a couple that I'm kind of curious about. Of course, one of course is 12 Years a Slave, which is Steve McQueen's new movie. It's certainly his biggest film to date of the three feature films he's now made. What you saw that, I don't doubt.
I did. That was one that was an 8:30 one. So that one you had to get up early and you...
Yeah.
Yes, it was... it's very good. It's very plain spoken. It's very direct. It is powerful. It reminded me of Roots, the ABC miniseries.
And it
reminded me how actually good that miniseries is. Even if you see it now and you think, you know, it's a little cheesy, the production values.
Right.
But actually over, 12, 14 hours, it was pretty complex, the portrait that they...
It was ambitious.
Very ambitious.
Right.
And this one is ambitious. It's on focus throughout, depicting the brutality of slavery in all of its manifestations. Very well acted. And it definitely was the movie that everyone was talking about. That, Gravity, which I did see, and Under the Skin, which I only saw part of. So I never saw how weird Under the Skin
was. You had to walk out on it to make another film.
What was that?
You had
I had to, yes.
It's interesting you refer to Roots because both films were based on on true stories, based on novels or rather pieces of work. I thought that at the 12 Years of Slave was based on the truth.
Right. It's based on the story. On this man's. Although I have a feeling though that they
took liberties.
Yeah. But then again, I'm not sure. I haven't researched.
That's okay. Tell me about what you were just talking about. What film?
Well, Gravity.
Gravity,
you know, the big film with Sandra Bullock, George Clooney.
Yeah.
And 3D space. It's 90 minutes, so it's very tight. It's suspenseful. It's a good film.
Uh-huh.
It's high-class hokum. You know, it is what it is. It's an adventure. One series of escapes and then leads to another.
So who directed that one?
Oh, Alfonso Cuarón.
Right.
If that's how you say it. You know, forgive me if that's not correct. But some of the films that I really, really liked were smaller films, largely set in North Africa, come to think of it, or in the Middle East. Not all of them. But my first day there, I ended up seeing two films about Rent Boys, and I wasn't looking for it. It just happened that Rent Boys were everywhere at Toronto.
What Rent Boy?
Rent Boys, Hustlers.
So, in other words, you're on vacation? And you're, right. Is that what it is?
No. But the one movie, I saw one film called Salvation Army, and it's a debut film by a Moroccan filmmaker based in Paris. And it's about, well, it's autobiographical, about growing up in Morocco, and he's a teenage kid who turns tricks here and there. Mm-hmm. And then he grows up, and you see what his life is afterwards.
So that was the North African version of Midnight Cowboy?
In a way, it's a little more somber than that, but yes.
More
and
somber?
Set in,
and no Sylvia Miles.
Well, okay, no, so yeah, she's not around, or Birdie Vaccaro. But it's impressionistic. It's not
gotcha.
Quite a linear film, but it's very, very memorable. And then I saw a film called Eastern Boys, which is directed by the co-writer of The Class, which was a French film a couple
Kanté?
Years ago.
Kanté?
Yes. Well, that was Kanté? The director of The Class. This man's name is... Oh, I have to look it up. Forgive me. He was one of
what
the co-writers.
What was it called?
Eastern Boys.
We'll find
and
it.
And it's about this very middle-class French man's relationship with a 15-year-old hustler from Eastern Europe. And it's quite good. Mm-hmm. It's one of the tougher films about immigration that is set in Europe. Oh, another beautiful film I saw was mm-hmm. called Siddharth, which was by a Canadian filmmaker, Richie Mehta, I believe that's the name. And it's set in India, and it's about a father who loses his son.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very terrifying scenario. He sends his son away to work 200 miles away, and the boy's supposed to come back a month later, but he never arrives.
How old is he?
12. And the father doesn't have a phone number for where the boy was sent. He doesn't have a name. He doesn't have a photograph. He doesn't have a cell phone. So the film is also about a certain mindset of
disconnection from
modern or contemporary of contemporary life, but it's mostly because of poverty. Because that's why he sent his son out 200 miles away to begin with, was because of the money. And the director said that he was inspired to make the film by talking to a taxi driver a few years ago in Mumbai. And his son disappeared, the taxi driver's, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what got the ball rolling. Hmm. It's a very...
Siddharth?
Siddharth, yes.
Is that any connection to Siddhartha, or is that just...
No, it's the boy's name.
Okay.
And so that was a very nice surprise. And another nice surprise was Bethlehem, which is set, of course, in
Israel?
Here in Bethlehem. And it's about an Israeli agent who has an asset on the other side of the wall, a Palestinian boy. And, of course, so it's kind of a spy movie, actually. But it's very much, you know, set in the Middle East of today. And it reminded me a lot of a film called Omar, which is going to be at the New York Film Festival. In fact, their storylines are so similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think Bethlehem is a little bit better in many ways. So that's one film for people to look out for.
Well, that's great. Any American films you saw that
Oh, yes. I saw Enough Said, the Nicole.
Sure.
And I liked it. It's,
yeah.
I like her films. I think they're very
Me
smart.
Too. Today I got the disappointing email from Fox Searchlight that Nicole, who is in New York this week, did not have enough time to come on the show.
Well, maybe another time. Maybe she'll be back.
Sure, of course. We'll get her on.
But,
I agree. I saw the film as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's not many films that have a main character who is so narcissistic and so clueless and so likable. I mean, that
you may have that right.
Yeah,
and not only that, but you very passive aggressive. We're talking about
right.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who yes. plays the lead character in Enough Said, who is a single mother, who in a way it goes out of her way almost to drive a wedge between herself and her daughter, and her daughter and her daughter's best friend. And does the same thing with the guy she's dating, played by the late James Gandolfini, and a friend she makes who happens to be married to James Gandolfini. It's very strange. And meanwhile, she's this sweetheart of a, like, you know, almost a Mary Tyler Moore for the contemporary day.
But you know, I think we all know people like that. Yeah. Who are very nice and right. very funny, very gracious and well-meaning, but yet they have their certain tics
right.
or their blinders.
Right.
So yeah, it's a very smart film.
Yeah.
So that was one American film. Oh, Joe.
David Gordon Green.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And it really grew on me.
It's Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm. It's very heavy Southern Gothic. You know, the underbelly of Texas is where it's set. Everyone is drunk. They're whoring. They're desperate living.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a thriller, but mm-hmm. it's really the relationship between Joe, played by Nicolas Cage, and a young teenage boy, played by Ty Sheridan, who is in Mud. And it's very similar to Mud, which came out earlier this year.
Yeah.
But it's much more, it's darker. Ooh, it's a darker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I do understand that in a way it's kind of both David Gordon Green, who was a recent guest on the show, but that it was an opportunity for David as well as for Nicolas Cage to kind of recalibrate their careers to some degree.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
Yeah. Anything else that stands out?
Well, I did one documentary, American documentary, The Dog, which
right,
will
based
be at
on
New York Film Festival. Based on the real life figure of Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
And it's very raunchy. He doesn't hold back. It's a fascinating look at New York in the 70s and, really gay life in the 70s. He was part of the gay liberation movement before he decided to rob the bank in Brooklyn to pay for the sex change operation for his lover.
Wife or husband.
Right. Well, I guess he considered his lover his wife. Mm-hmm. They actually did marry, and there is very ancient videotape of the marriage ceremony
wow.
in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's worth seeing. And then another film I saw, not American, but it's another film about film history in a way, is Ain't Misbehavin', which is about Marcel Ophuls, the director of The Sorrow mm-hmm. of the Pity and much, much more. And it's also about his father. And so, are you familiar with him?
I believe I just saw the Earrings of Madame Du. Isn't that
oh,
his?
That was his father.
Max.
Right,
Ophuls.
So Marcel.
Yeah, Marcel, what did he do?
The Sorrow and the Pity.
Okay.
And also Hotel Terminus.
Oh,
those,
very
I
good.
Guess, are his two well-known, most well-known films. And so, as a boy, he left Nazi Germany with his family, settled in France, then Switzerland, then Hollywood, and then back in France. And a very fascinating career. I mean,
wow.
it's very conversational. It may not be in depth, but certainly fascinating. And he certainly is a filmmaker that deserves a higher profile. Not that he hasn't gone away, but
yeah. You did you see Night Moves, Kelly Reichardt?
I did see Night Moves, and I liked it. I was a bigger fan of her last film, Meek's Cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
This one it's very impressionistic. It's very much more. I think she's more interested in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. which is fine. I did feel it was a little too long and a little too underbaked for me.
Mm-hmm.
The second hour, I was not as connected to it as I was in the first half. But a great score. Great score, great cinematography.
Mm.
But that, yes, so that is one American film.
Because we're trying to get her on, too. So. And also, did you catch the Jim Jarmusch film, Only Lovers Left Alive?
No, but I went to the party. Does that count?
Yes.
Okay.
Tell me about that.
No, the party, it was fine. It was downtown at the courthouse. Everyone, they were very liberal in who they let in, so it was very packed. It was very festive.
Was Jim Jarmusch there?
I didn't see him.
Okay.
No, the only celebs I saw were Harvey Weinstein, who was on the plane, on the same plane mm-hmm. as I on the way over. And then Dan.
Did he sit behind you?
No, believe it or not, no. And then I saw Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey. The young
Which
lord.
One?
He's the lord, the one who's not going to be back next season.
I've only seen the first season.
Oh, yeah. So, Yeah, so I think those were... Oh, and then I saw a big Israeli superstar, who's the one who looks like Tom Cruise. Name escapes me. So those were the three celebs.
Very good.
Thank you.
It sounds like you had a good time.
Oh, I did, actually, looking back. The week, it felt like maybe 4 days.
And you didn't... I can't imagine that you saw the new Frederick Wiseman documentary, because it's I think, it around 4 hours long.
Exactly. I avoided the really, really long movies because...
Which you do regardless.
I'm sorry, what?
Which you do regardless.
No, I see some long movies, but at a festival, when you can squeeze in two or three films...
Of course. No. Yeah. Of course, it's that's the game. Thank you, man. You're like a cornucopia.
Well, I aim to please.
And you have. You've really brought us up to date on the Toronto International Film Festival.
Hope so.
2013. What's next?
Oh, well, the New York Film Festival.
Right.
Which is just, it's going to start very soon.
Yeah.
And see for that, Club Sandwich by Fernando Imbeke, I think that's his name. Mm-hmm. He made Duck Season about 10 years ago. It's a very low-key mother mm-hmm. and son, a very kind of twisted mother and son relationship, but we all can relate to whether we really want to admit to it or not. Mm-hmm. And also the film by Agnes B., the designer Agnes B., called My Name Is Odd name, odd film, but it's a good film.
Hmm. I mean, really?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
We'll check it out. I have to go, as you know, can imagine, I'm going to be having to see public screenings this year.
I will be going to some of them as well, so I'll bump into you in the lobby.
Well, let's try to coordinate a little bit here so we can see a couple of things together. Kent Turner, thank you so much for coming
welcome.
On Film. Back to Film Wax Radio.
Yes.
You'll come back again?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
You're on.
Lunch is the untold story of New York's greatest legend and one of the most iconic images of the 20th century, a photograph called Lunch Atop a Skyscraper, which was taken on the 69th floor of the Rockefeller Building in the autumn of 1932. You've seen this photograph a million times. Filmmaker Sean O'Coulon is my guest today on Film Wax Radio. And his film, which is being distributed by First Run Features, is currently playing in New York at the Quad Cinema. So go check it out. In Boston, it will play on the Boston University campus starting October 3rd. It will be playing at the Lamy Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills on October 4th. And at the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland, starting October 10th. My conversation with Sean O'Coulon.
Centuries of aspiration and immigration and work and struggle and tragedy and triumph that went into making the New York of the 1920s. And this was the moment that New York became New York.
Like any great photograph, it sparks wonder. What kind of men would do this? What the heck is going on here? Who are they?
Italians, Irish, all coming from somewhere else, and it speaks to the immigrant experience.
These are the descendants of immigrants who came and were utterly alien in New York, and now they are quintessential New Yorkers.
What caught my eye was probably his eyes. Almost like the hair in the back of my neck stood up. I said, Jesus, that's the old man.
Sean O'Coulon, welcome to Filmwax Radio. It's nice to have you on the podcast.
Thanks very much.
Have you done a podcast before?
I think I might have.
Really?
Might have, yeah.
Oh, so you're...
Back home.
Oh, yeah. Is that popular there in Ireland? Because maybe I have an issue there.
But it's all the same, I think, isn't it? It just depends when the message is relayed.
Yeah. Also, Ireland could discover this. Maybe now that you're going to be on here, there'll be a few people in Ireland listening to the
podcast. I think they're sick of our story by now. Yeah. We got a release in Ireland last year, and we had a broadcast in Ireland last year. So we pushed it fairly well, and there's a huge interest in the photograph anyways, because most Irish people are reared with that photograph, in the knowledge that there were Irish people on it, and our documentary, you know, added weight to that belief, and people really do. It's part of Irish culture now, that photograph, as much as it is American.
That's a new angle on it. I'm glad you brought it up. Let's just fill in a couple of the blanks, though, for our listeners. That one is the name of the film, is At Men at Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You directed it.
Mm-hmm.
It tells the story, mostly unknown. It's a kind of like an onion, a mystery peeling back the layers, right?
It is. It's
about this most famous and most valuable photograph ever taken, they say.
It is one of the most. It is, according to Corbis, is most valuable photograph in their archive.
Right.
And it's a strange story that we had to tell, because when we started off making the documentary, it started off as a very simple Irish documentary to prove that two Irish families, to follow that claim of two Irish families. And I thought that I would have to go search Amazon, get the PBS documentary, get the book, and half my research would be done.
But there was no
book.
And there was no documentary.
No PBS doc done. Long term, that's good. But short term, at the time, when there's no research line in your budget, you are climbing the walls, saying, what am I going to do here? So the documentary went from being a simple investigative story to telling the whole story of the photograph, the history of the photograph.
What photograph?
The lunch atop a skyscraper.
Right. Which is so iconic. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine anybody who's ever passed a postcard rack
mm-hmm.
hasn't seen it, or a poster shop. It's usually in the window of just about every poster shop, correct?
Mm-hmm. It's probably the most iconic, I hate using that word all the time, but it's always the most iconic New York photograph there is.
Definitely.
Because it means so much. It can mean so much.
Yeah.
Because the men are somebody, of course.
Yeah.
The men are somebody, but they could also be anybody. And because there's so much mystery around it, and it's of a particular time in American history, when the city was being rebuilt, just after the Depression, mm-hmm. and it was just ordinary iron workers. Ordinary workers were built that. They weren't. So the fact that, I think the fact that they were just ordinary workers, that's one of the main reasons I think that the photograph still lives today, because when I've spoken to the new immigrants who are coming to America, the Chinese, mm-hmm. the Asians, South Americans, when they come and they look at the photograph, they don't see, they have no direct connection with it, the photograph, they see immigrants on the ladder.
Sure.
Working their way up.
Right.
And I think that's why it still resonates with them.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful. I was in an audience with you when we had that screening. I think it was not only your New York premiere, but I'm going to guess it was your U.S. premiere.
Correct, yeah. It was
last
US fall. Premiere. Last fall, yeah.
Doc NYC, and I was fortunate enough to moderate one of your Q&As, which was a pleasure, and everybody was really into the film. Everybody who's basically sitting in there is an immigrant or a child of an immigrant. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we can all relate to that photo in that way.
You're preaching to the converted. In many ways.
Yes, if preaching is even required. And everybody loves a good photograph. The photographer, the maybe remaining two or three people don't know what we're talking about. Men are. It's a striking shot of a beam that's, right?
That's right. The 69th floor of Rockefeller Center has been just nearing construction. 81 years ago this weekend. It was.
Is it this week? Oh, and that's this weekend. Lovely because it's the weekend of your theatrical.
That's right. It's the Friday. It's the 81st anniversary of the photograph. The date was unknown until we went working in the Rockefeller Archive, and we searched, and we finally cross-referenced the photograph with other photographs taken that day, and we found that the photograph, the true date of the photograph. And one of the great things that, one of the most memorable things for me from the whole documentary, and the whole search to find out who these men were, was to actually see the original glass plate negative that was taken that day, because the monkey on that photograph's back. And I think a lot of it's not really taken as a serious photograph. One of the reasons, I believe, is that people think it's a hoax, that it's a fake.
Well, it seems almost impossible to imagine that anybody would have it's not just the guts to sit on the edge of a pier 69 flights above ground.
With no harness, with nothing,
sitting there. But also being as casual as drinking a thermos cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's that casualness, of course. But so that was the monkey on its back, and to actually find the glass negative, albeit broken, the glass plate negative from that day, and to be there in the room when it was confirmed that it was the original glass plate, because the owners of the glass plate negative, Corbus, had never confirmed yay or nay whether it was the original glass plate negative. So to be there and have the cameras rolling for that was a highlight.
So you go through the trail of identifying a number of the guys through various clues and interviews and whatnot. And then during that process, you do something that was really fascinating, which was you could please describe how you got this idea and how you executed it. But you did these 360-degree. They weren't all photographs, right? You created them, right? These images of from all angles of the guys on the beam.
I couldn't
have described it more awkwardly, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I got you because I've lived and breathed the last 2 years. So it was two parts. So one was a 3D rostronaut, which we just separated the men from the background, and that worked. We always felt that the people are just. There's only so many times you can show that photograph in a film before people actually get you take from it. And we wanted to give people something new. So the first part of it was the separation of the men from the beam. Absolutely brilliant work done by Thomas Leverett, a visual effects artist and a short film director. He was working on a short film at the time of the men. And we worked on that. And it's just, we come up from the men from behind.
Yeah, it's...
And you see the sprawling Manhattan skyline. It's a track in from behind them. It's just a completely different perspective. And the first time I saw that, it shook me.
Yeah,
because it's just completely different. You're just so used to seeing this this angle, and that's the limits of photography. You can only see that angle.
Right.
That when someone has the imagination to create something from an opposite angle, it was truly remarkable. And when we saw that in our rough cut, when he delivered that to us, we were saying, whoa. And I still look at that 2 years later, and I say to myself, whoa, this has created something absolutely unbelievable.
How long did the film take you to make?
2 years.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of that is because of finance and trying to get money. And it received its international premiere at Toronto last year, at TIFF. And the cut that was in New York last year is a different cut of what's seen now. Because in the meantime, we came across new information about the men and new, and also a new photograph.
Can you maybe drop one piece of information without being too much of a spoiler? One new development?
Well, the main development was we came across another photograph of the 11 men, but this time waving their hats in the air. And it's a remarkable photograph because we're so used to seeing this one particular shot
ignoring
of these
the
men
camera.
In this pose. You can only see that pose. You only associate that particular pose that they have in that shot with them. So when you see them in a different pose with the hats off, open the hands.
Are they
hands
looking at the camera?
Looking at the camera.
So they were nodding to the camera. So the first, maybe one guy was looking kind of at the camera?
Yeah, the one guy. I'm sure he got a good telling off from the photographer for looking at the camera.
I don't remember all
he this. He was the He's staring the camera down, and that's one of the draws of the photograph, that there's just one particular guy in the far left,
yeah,
holding a bottle, staring at the camera, and he's giving it a good New yeah. York attitude. Yeah.
These were men's men. They were truly the salt of the earth, you know.
They were, and you can tell that these men. Well, I can see from my nails, coming from a rural society in Ireland, that you can tell that these men, even though they are immigrants, and they were, most of them probably born, a lot of them were probably born in America, that they men who had maybe were only one generation away from the land, that they had this kind of earthliness about them and a down to earth about them, albeit at 69 feet. That was still ingrained in who they were, that they were still probably a rural people. Live in the biggest city in the world.
And building the future with their hands. Like, I mean, they would never have been able to conceive of what would be in these buildings just a generation later.
That's true. Well, I suppose you, later,
and it kind of has that. It's kind of, there's something almost bittersweet about that for some reason.
Mm. You have to realize as well that most of these immigrants, when they came off the boats, the New York skyline was just beginning to take shape. So you can imagine leaving the backwater of Europe, or if you happen to leave Europe just after the First World War, it was in ruins. And there you arrive in Ellis Island, and all of a sudden you see these skyscrapers. For the first time, you see skyscrapers. So this was the year that these men were building the future. But at the same time, I think the iron workers who are building the World Trade Center at the moment, they're building for the future too.
Well said. That's true. There's a timelessness there too. So Men at Lunch is directed by Sean O'Coulon, and it is produced by a relative of yours, if I'm not incorrect, right?
Well, if my mother's theory is right that we're brothers, it's correct.
Eamon O'Coulon?
That's right, O'Coulon. Yeah.
He's your producer. I think he was there that day, too. I got to meet him.
Right.
And it's currently in theaters right now, so don't waste any more time. Go see this movie. If you're, I don't know, if you're a photograph enthusiast, or you are a son of a or daughter of an immigrant, or you are a New Yorker, or you like going to the film movies, any of those reasons are enough to see, and perhaps a combination of all of those. Mm. First Run Features is releasing it, so everything they do is, I think, really the best. So I think it's a great partnership.
It's working well for us.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sean. And I would ask you to come back on the 19th anniversary of your film, because it will also be the 100th anniversary of the photograph.
Will you buy me a drink?
I will buy you a drink.
Cool. I'll be back.
And again, the guys from Detonator, filmmakers Damon and Kier, and actor Ben Fine. You will hopefully see the film in some manner of speaking, and whether it be online, on demand, or in a theater near you very soon. I hope so, and I would assume so. It's a really entertaining film with a lot of piss and vinegar, as my grandpa used to say. So here it is, Detonator. Chapter will be long on the grass.
talk about everything till it's easier. Your beauty is nothing compared to what.
You'll never guess who called me.
Who?
Nick.
What do you want?
Holy shit. How you doing, jackass?
Hey, look at you.
Wow, you're like a soccer mom.
I had a son.
Everything okay with him?
Albert!
I'm dreaming dreams. I'm scheming schemes. I'm building castles high.
How do you two guys know each other?
I was in Detonator.
I don't...
Are you kidding me?
I was in a band with Sully.
That was a long time ago.
You're all set up here. It's a cozy little place. It's coming together.
Things are really, really tight.
Are you still writing?
No.
You play, though, right?
Sometimes you have to make hard decisions.
Maybe the hard decision would have been to stick with it.
I just have a family. I have mouths to feed. I have goals. Do you have any goals?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's no FCC rules here, I don't think. But there
not
are,
yet. There will be soon.
All right, so we are with Damon Malucci, Keir Politz, and Ben Fine, right?
You know, yeah, I was going to try to correct you, but you got it in one.
You know, my mother's family's side is all Fine. It's all Fine.
Fine is a pretty. It's like a Smith. It's like a Jewish Smith. So we are all Feinbergs and Feinsteins.
But I'm saying there's a chance we're related.
Really,
Ben Fine.
Well, it's like my father's name is Ellis, which is also like a fake name catch-all, and so Ellis and Fine are both. Yeah, they're just like we're basically criminals. So historically, the Ellises and the Fines. Including your mother, by the way, are probably criminals. Just so you know.
Okay.
Yeah, you're. But some people are spell Fine F E I N, and some spell it F I N E.
That's true.
And we are of the same spelling.
So that means you're Jewish.
Yes, I am.
Right. So the people that are spelled sure. differently are not Jewish, in general.
Oh, okay.
That would be perfect.
Anyway, we're here with Keir Politz and Damon Malucci as well. Who are the co-directors of a film that you are, Ben, you are one of the actors in, and it's called Detonator.
Get ready to rock.
Yeah. Detonator, and I guess the name comes from one of the lead characters, or the two lead characters' former band
yes.
that they both were in.
Yes.
Right, Keir?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep.
Do you want to give a little backstory so
sure.
our listeners know what the film's about? And this music we're listening to in the background, by the way, is on the soundtrack. Do you want to talk? No.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like we were ahead of our time. We were ahead of our time.
It's real. This is punk at its best, its finest.
We are in a discotheque in Ibiza right now. Nah, I don't know. Detonator is a story of the main character was in a band when he was younger in the West Philadelphia punk scene. And he was in a band. The main character is played by Lawrence Levine. And... He has since moved on with his life. He has a child. He has a significant other.
Yeah,
he's living in the suburbs.
He's moved into a more conventional lifestyle.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And a problematic person from his past, who was also in the band with him, returns to his life and creates chaos for a day and puts him in a circumstance that he needs to deal with. And really, it's the past that was never really dealt with,
mm-hmm.
and this guy comes crashing back into his world.
Damon, do you want to add anything to that description of the film?
I think Keir did a pretty good job. Detonator is the name of the band that they were in.
Yeah, yeah.
But it could also be some things that are going on underneath.
So. Yeah, we always looked at the return of this character who's played by Ben as, you know, this guy that sort of trips a wire. In this guy's existence, and you know he's sort of he's standing on this wire, and what do? You need to figure it out, or it could potentially decimate your reality that you're living in right now in some way.
Yeah, and we were talking about this earlier. Before we pressed record, you know, the idea of these two friends and what they meant to each other and their journey, and you know, in a lot of ways, the lead character played by Lawrence Levine. His name is Sully, and, you know, Ben comes into his life, but he, you know, Ben is almost reading a beacon that Sully puts out from the beginning of the film. And and Sully is certainly leaving a trail for Ben. You know, he's calling to him and picking up on signals. So certainly Sully is active in this you know, and awakening the Kraken that is Mick.
Yeah, I mean, he's having a hard time assimilating to this new identity that he's dealing with, and this guy comes in and really just, you know, initially he yanks him out of it and brings him into this sort of, you know, these more thrilling times that he remembers. So there's, you know, there's definitely a strong affection for this problematic character as well.
Sure, and also, right, there's like Ben, your character is like the id in the film in a sense, but also there are all these unresolved things from the past, so that's also, so it's almost as like the when Ben's character returns to Larry's life, he drags him right into this unresolved drama.
Right.
So it's easy for them to fall right back in the old track with they owe money, and there's burnt bridges, and they've got to kind of resolve these the tension with this with Robert Longstreet's character, who is
the major physical threat in the film. And I mean, I think that it's something that everybody can relate to, because we have these exciting times in our teenage years into our early 20s, and then everything just sort of stops, and you fall into this other routine. But it's almost as if all of those things that were happening were happening yesterday or last week. So with the return of this guy, it's as if everything is immediately awakened, and he's taken back there very quickly. And Robert Longstreet, who plays the character of Dutch, who is a little bit older and was a mentor figure, and he's this anarchist, very intense. He was also in a band, but he was also a guy that recorded bands and mentored bands and kind of brought them up through their own little system in that world there.
And he's really the keeper of this scene that is, kind of dwindling, but, you know, he is the pulse of it and kind of a dragon in this lair, you know, in a lot of ways, to keep on this Joseph Campbellian style that I'm talking about here, this mythological journey.
Right.
But you know, when we were talking about the idea of who's a threat, and I think I have more to say than that, but I think...
No, I'm listening to you.
I'd like to hear what Mr. Fine...
No, I'm listening. We were talking about Gilgamesh and Enkidu, and we were talking... I mean, because I guess what I was thinking is that, like, because we're talking about, like, Mick coming into this world and sort of taking... and dragging him down into the inferno or something like that, but I have always thought that the reason it's so easy for Sully to come back into it is that Mick never left. It's like, and if you look back on my own history as I've gotten older, is that like I was 20, and like I closed my eyes, and I was 40. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And so at least like I've been asleep, and so ultimately, Mick has always been there. And the reason it's like he gets dragged down so quickly and so easily is that every day he's been battling, and you see before even Mick is calling, he's thinking about whether he should sell his amp. He's thinking about whether he should do these things.
He tries to sell his amp.
But he doesn't do it. But these are the impulses of this other id character that is already deeply involved in his own life. So it's about Sully deciding which of his mythic now I feel bad because I'm talking about Joseph Campbell, but like,
right.
Yeah, but which of his mythic characters he's going to kill, because they're both strong and they're both powerful and they both have like potentially very intense and meaningful futures, depending on how he goes about it.
And really, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but
yeah,
it's very much about. No, I'm saying I don't want to give it away. It's very much about cutting all of those lines and being in the moment. I mean, really, this is a story about fathers and sons. This is a story about families, and this is a story about, you know, this is a story about being comfortable enough with who you are so that you can be in the moment with the people who are truly important in your life.
Yeah, and
now.
And if I can interject, you know, that's where we start with our Sully. He is certainly not in the moment. I mean, he's... We start with him going about his day, and being in, you know, part of this new job, and being, you know, feeling detached, and picking up his son, and going through the motions. I mean, he loves his son, but literally not being there for him, having his son recognize in his 5-year-old perspective whether his father is there, is with him, is lost. So you know, and he has to go back to the past that he hasn't dealt with,
right.
which you know, I don't want to give away, like, which brings us to where he began, you know, we begin with him trying to sell an amp, trying to remove literal remnants of the past.
Right. He's trying to deny parts of himself.
And,
exactly. So the rest of the film is about him actually having to figure out how to find the balance of the side from his past, where he was more driven by the id, and then the rest where, you know, it's a more stable, and so he's trying to find that balance, and
far less exciting in a lot of far less exciting in a lot of ways, but ultimately the only truly fulfilling aspect of your existence.
Just tell me a little bit about how you split up your duties, Kira and Damon, and also tell me a little bit also about casting, because a lot of the people in the film are friends of this particular podcast. Larry and Sophia have been both, Sophia is Larry's real-life wife. They've done a number of films together, and in this one, Sophia plays a temptation over the course of the evening. She works at the bar...
At the punk club,
where Robert owns.
Dutch's place.
Spot and his operation.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm kind of curious also, though, and then there's Robert. Joe Swanberg has a kind of a cameo, if you want to call it that. Ben's, of course, in the film, Ben Fine. I know you can mention the other actors.
We have Don L. Hall, who it plays Sully's wife, and you know, she is very much there in the beginning, and her presence, you know what he's got to get back to, and what's there.
There's also the most trained and the best actor in the movie you're leaving out,
which is the young Albert, played by
Albert.
Chris Maloof.
Yeah, Chris.
LaMoth.
I mean, the conversations we would have when the camera wasn't rolling, and the things he would say to me were just like, it would blow me away.
He wrote the third act.
Basically.
He wrote the third act.
I mean, I wouldn't know what to do, and I'd be like, hey, man, I'm not getting this scene, and you both are really good, but he could just say with one word. He was really, really good. No, he was actually really, really cute, really, really sweet. He was great, but it's hard to work with a kid. Now I'm certainly not used to it. I think everyone in the film had a time where we were secretly in the scene. So every scene that he plays in, there's one of us like beside him, like either coaxing or like, it was, I mean, he was in, it was, that was the most fun acting experience I had, was working with him.
And I mean, the nice thing about him is he was very patient and he was very focused, and he just, on some level, he got what we were trying to do there. And, you know, this is a good transition in the way Damon and I work. You know, we've been collaborating for years. We've been working on each other's, you know, just in terms of the writing. You know, we went to graduate school together at Columbia, and also with Lawrence. And we reached a point where we both had projects that were moving forward, but they were sort of, you know, hitting these potholes along the way. And we just decided that we wanted to do something. And there was this idea that I had been kicking around, and there was some interest there, and we needed to turn a script around very quickly for an actor that was interested in the project. So we cranked this thing out in like 2 weeks, you know, a first draft, and that actor became unavailable, and we just decided to make this film, and we decided to do it ourselves, to take it back, to make this film. And, you know, so we really worked. It was a pretty evenly divided responsibilities,
the old idea. I mean, we literally would probably take turns, one at the typewriter, one pacing around, although we did a lot of it over, you know, technology. We did a lot of it through video, G-Chat, and Skype, and in person.
Because I'm based in Philadelphia and he's in Brooklyn. So.
Yeah, but we even had, you know, a meeting at one of Kier's families.
Yeah,
holy. As the music kicks in.
Totally. Kier, you're in Philadelphia. Damon is in Brooklyn. And Ben, you're in Brooklyn.
This is my theme?
No, I was saying you're in Brooklyn. We really can't even hear each other. We're sitting like...
We have mutual friends, basically. So in terms of like me getting involved, like I just put up my a rough cut of my reel, and we have connections. This is intense.
So let me go backwards a little bit and say that... You know, as Kier was saying,
I thought we were just dancing to the music for a while.
Are they going to turn it down, Kay?
Okay. That they work together. I can talk about how you work together on set.
That's always interesting to get from an outside perspective.
I think it was like two sensitive dads.
My two dads.
And I was on...
No, I like to say I was the guy with the cool skinny tie, but maybe I was...
It was funny because like one is... like is like they, I think they both had a very good sense of what they wanted from a scene that they agreed on. Which is pretty rare, because you're working with a lot of people, and a lot of people have different choices about what they think they're doing, about what they think this movie is about, like the actors, the set directors, the set people, the cinematographer. Everyone's doing, in some ways, like a different project. But like Kieran Damon, despite having very different styles, we're doing the same project. I think you clearly have different styles. And it's funny because I think this is a story that you probably have told, is they would often say, cut. At the very same time, despite after
instinctually, which is kind of funny,
But like ultimately, one would come up and whisper something to you, and then go back, and then they would whisper to each other, and you do the scene, and then the other person would come up to you after that and whisper something entirely different to you, and then they go back and they mutter to each other, and you do the scene, and then
by design.
They're very manipulative, manipulative directors. I had more fun with that. I mean, it's not like we didn't know what was going on, but I thought it was very cute. So you had one person that was going to give you one style of direction, another who would give you another, and so basically by the third take, you could finally get it all together and move forward.
Well, so this is interesting. Co-directors on set. I mean, I think we were definitely unorthodox in the sense that there wasn't one person who was the visual and one who was the performance wrangler. You know, we both. I think what Ben's speaking to is we were not cool enough in the sense that we were like, okay, I'm into the role that I fall into because I can't help myself. But I think what would happen was we had a certain sensibility together, and we each developed our own vocabulary with our actors, which I think is really important.
Yeah.
And that's what's great about our set. I mean, not that everything was perfect, but that we did understand, you know, we had a relationship with our actors, each of them, and our DP. And so in our own vocabulary, we would come and talk to you in the way, you know, in whatever way that was. And by the third take, you might very well get it. But I will say, Kier and I, this is kind of how we worked together. We really wrote this script. I mean, to the point where I can't, if pressed in a court of law, maybe, but I really can't remember what lines were mine, what ideas were his. It really just became what this was for me. And then, and that kind of happened on a daily basis over a long period of time. And I will say that what I think is kind of interesting is when we decided to bring on Benjamin Ellis Fine, I had known Ben through some friends that he'd known for a long time, friends of friends, and he'd been in my periphery for years. And just getting the essence of this fine actor, no pun intended, I knew that this. I said to Kier, I think I have our guy. You know, once we felt empowered, once we felt confident with our material, and once we felt empowered to do it on a scope that we knew that we could do it, and we said, hey, we actually know guys with the chops. We know guys who can pull this off. Let's do it with them and stop kind of wasting our time on this.
Stop reaching out. Reaching out to these. People who were sort of beyond, people who would have made it a very different project.
Yeah. Right. And once we did that, I said, I know this guy, and I showed him this reel that Ben very briefly spoke about. But I also said, I know that for better and worse, Ben is going to push all of us because I know the type of, Ben, you have a great range, but I know the kind of worker that you are, even in your printing.
I'm a letterpress printer for my job.
And I know, I was like, he's going to push all of us. And if we do this right, it's going to be the kind of pushing that's going to elevate. And I knew that when him and Lawrence Michael Levine got together for, whatever the relationship would be, they would make each other better. We are so excited by the chemistry and what they were able to do.
We had a great time shooting the trailer in the snow. It was actually the coldest night of the year. It was below zero. But it was actually still... Mm-hmm. still fun. Just let me say it's fun, then you can have the mic.
No, I was just going to say we shot like a teaser. To raise money for the film,
sure,
and we shot it in the middle of January.
What'd you do?
We didn't do Kickstarter. We sort of just took that idea and did a little bit different.
You did your DIY'd your own.
Yeah. We did sort of like a very
begging.
Grassroots
begging.
Early like small amounts.
Understand.
But we did it all ourselves, and then we also used it to reach out to the small and medium sized investors that would actually
make the film. You'll be glad to know that I don't ask budget questions on this show.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thanks.
I figure it's not
Thanks,
my
Adam.
Business. well, the film is called Detonator, and again, the co-directors are Keir Politz and Damon Malucci, and it stars. There's quite an ensemble in this film of recognizable indie faces, including Lawrence Michael Levine and Sophia Decal and Ben Ellis Fine, Robert Longstreet, Joe Swanberg, and again Don Hall. She's very good too. Very good. Great casting. And
can I say, shot by Michael Cano beautifully, and edited by Matthew L. Weiss, who's New York-based and amazing editor.
Yeah, Matt really had a lot to do with making this film happen.
Well, it's a really fun film to watch, and I know you guys are about to head into a Q&A for your film, by the way, so just give you a heads up. Ben, thank you. Ben Fine.
We have to answer more questions. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, don't worry. Yeah. It'll be short. You know, people are cold and wet.
You're motivated now. You've got your revving to go.
Well, thank you for having us, Adam.
And Damon Malucci, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us. Film Wax rules.
Yeah. Tune in.
Get in the car. Last chance.
Why do you think I'm standing here talking? What do you think I want to know?
He's gonna fucking kill me, please!
What are you doing?
Ladies and gentlemen, in case you forgot him, Detonator!
Okay, guys, that's the show. We begin my next year on this planet with that great show. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, I just want to mention is Christine Vachon. She's a very, very well-known producer. Christine has produced a film coming up called "Kill Your Darlings," and I think it's going to be a major hit. So, very happy to have Christine coming up on one of the next shows. Also coming up, Matt Porterfield, who has his latest film. You may remember Matt's, if you're an independent film lover, you will remember Matt's last film, which was called Putty Hill. If you haven't seen it, please do try and see it. It's terrific. And he has a new film called I Used to Be Darker, which will be in theaters on October 4th. So we're going to have Matt on an upcoming show. Also coming up is the team behind the film Doomsdays. This film is still sort of making its way through festivals as well. The filmmaker, Eddie Mullins, will be on the show with two of the film's stars. Also coming up soon is the filmmaker Jim Mickle, who has a new horror film called We Are What We Are. And I'm especially happy that we'll be joined by the great actor Bill Sage on that show. So, I don't know what you're doing, but if you haven't subscribed to Filmwax Radio on iTunes, you're transgressing. You really are. So get on top of it, and you got to do this right now. If you've got the new iPhone or an old iPhone, go onto iTunes, and for God's sake, you know, you'll want to subscribe to that. Actually, I think you might have to get the podcast app on your phone or tablet, but you can figure it out. Please go on there. Please give the show the best rating that you feel it deserves. Leave comments there. Email me at adam@filmwax.com. Please be generous. I really, really will appreciate it. Send me your feedback and thoughts about the show, about everything. I'm so truly interested in hearing from you. That's the show. This is Adam Chartoff. You've been listening to yet another episode of Film Wax Radio presented by Rooftop Films and A&T. Until next time, thanks for listening.